I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today on Midday, mandatory minimums and monuments. Last night, the Baltimore City Council narrowly passed a preliminary measure related to a bill that at one time could have meant a mandatory jail term for anyone with an illegal gun. The debate has reopened a conversation about the role of judges and the best way to make our streets safer. I'll speak with two councilmen who are on opposite sides of this issue, Eric Costello, who voted for it, and Brandon Scott, who opposed it. We'll also talk to both city leaders about the fate of four Confederate monuments in Mount Vernon, Bolton Hill, and Charles Village. Plus, comedian Harry Kondabolu joins me to reflect on what it means to be a person of color in an age where it takes 2 days for the president to condemn the Klan. Midday starts right after the news. Sounds of demonstrators on North Charles Street Sunday evening over by Johns Hopkins. They're shouting, "Fists up, fight back, stop a fascist in his track." We are going to begin today here on Midday with a conversation about mandatory minimums and monuments, two issues that are dominating much of the national dialogue about race in this week, where white nationalists murdered a woman on the streets of an American city, and protests across the country, including here in Baltimore, erupted over monuments to Confederates who fought to preserve slavery. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us this afternoon. Last night, the Baltimore City Council advanced a substantially attenuated version of a bill that in its original form mandated a year-long sentence for anyone in possession of an illegal handgun. Plus, after the tragedy in Charlottesville last weekend, cities large and small across the country are wrestling with what to do with monuments to the Confederacy. In Annapolis, Speaker Mike Bush has called for the statue of Roger Taney, the author of the Dred Scott decision, to be removed from the State House grounds. He's not the first person to call for that. Senate President Mike Miller has offered tepid support, saying that he wouldn't stand in the way. In a flagrant display of fearless political courage, Miller punted it to Governor Larry Hogan, who says that he will consider removing the statue. Here in Baltimore, Mayor Catherine Pugh tells the Baltimore Sun that she's been in touch with contractors about removing four Confederate monuments in Mount Vernon, Bolton Hill, and Charles Village. Yesterday in Durham, North Carolina, a crowd of protesters simply yanked one down in front of the Durham County Courthouse. So what should Baltimore do with our Confederate monuments, and how fast should we do it? I'm joined today by two members of the Baltimore City Council. 11th District Councilman Eric Costello joins us on the phone. Councilman, nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me today, Tom.
And 2nd District Councilman Brandon Scott is here with me in Studio A. Mr. Scott, always a pleasure, sir.
Thanks for having me again, sir.
And thank you for joining us. Again, if you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Mr. Costello, let's talk first about the mandatory minimum bill. A vote was taken last night. There were some protesters outside opposing the bill. You supported it. Mr. Scott opposed it. It was a close vote, 8-7. Tell us what the bill in its current iteration will do, should it make it all the way through and become law.
Sure. So the bill has been pretty heavily amended. What it does now is it ensures that individuals who are arrested for illegal possession of a firearm, which essentially matches the state language for illegal possession of a handgun, those folks, if they have a previous illegal possession charge for a handgun or are using a handgun in the commission of a crime on a person or a property and don't have that previous charge, that they are subject to the one-year jail sentence along with a $1,000 fine if they are convicted.
And why do you think that this is necessary? I mean, because there are those who point out that there are state laws on the books that would cover this sort of thing. The $1,000 fine perhaps is an extra added element of the city legislation. But why do you think this is, you and others, President Jack Young, the city council president, the mayor has come out in support of this, the police commissioner has supported this legislation. Why do you think this can be effective?
Well, there's a couple reasons. I think the most important thing to note here, though, is that the state's attorney's office still maintains prosecutorial discretion, meaning that they do not have to charge for this. It's only if they choose to charge for it and an individual is convicted by a jury of their peers, then they are subject to this specific penalty. But I think when you look at the data, when you look at 605 illegal handgun possession charges over a year and a half period, in which something like 60% of those have had a suspended sentence of less than half of the original sentence, you have a problem. We had the police commissioner come in and give us example after example of individuals who were let back out on the street with a grossly reduced suspended sentence and ended up killing someone within that year that they would have spent in jail otherwise had they been sentenced properly.
But, Councilman, it sounds to me like you're willing to give the prerogative and the discretion to the state's attorney's office when it comes to whether or not to charge somebody under this statute, but you're also interested in taking away the discretion of judges in these cases who are looking at them, you know, one case at a time. How do you reconcile that?
I don't know that it's that binary. I think this is more in the gray. I think there are cases where an individual may have a firearm illegally where they don't necessarily go to jail for a year. And I'm sure that, you know, in many of my conversations with Councilman Scott, he's going to talk about those examples. But I think by and large, it's important to set the standard in Baltimore City that if you carry an illegal handgun, you can expect to go to jail. Those are the consequences. And the current consequences aren't enough to scare people from carrying those illegal firearms on our streets and wreaking havoc on our communities.
And Councilman Scott, we're going to have more chance to talk after a break when Mr. Costello has to leave us. But just briefly, I mean, just yesterday here in our city, five shootings, one which results in a fatality, two mm-hmm. teenagers involved in these shootings. And the police commissioner and so many others have said, we got to get the guns off the streets. So if these are, as they used to call them, bad guys with guns, why not incarcerate these particular people?
Well, I think it's a very complex issue. And I think for me, the very simple thing about mandatory minimums is that we have 30 years of data that say they don't work, right? But more importantly, as someone who was on the council and in city government through 2007 through 2014, when violent crime was going down each and every year to historic levels, we didn't have a mandatory minimum. We didn't need a mandatory minimum city legislation then. We don't need it now. But more importantly, I think that my colleague knows that I'm a data junkie. Right. So we can say that we want to they can say that they want to put these people in jail. But the truth is that gun arrests are down 30% in the city. So even if they had this legislation, which in my humble opinion now can't even be enforced because it mirrors the state legislation, it should have been removed from consideration after the amendments. It's not going to have the desired impact. And this is the reality, Tom. Guys on the street who kill people do not fear 1 year jail time. That's the reality. We have to look at how we're going to, and this is something that I talk about in my crime plan for Baltimore and I talk about extensively. We have to look at how we can start to, again, federally prosecute these folks and send them away for hard time, because 1 year isn't going to do it, and they don't fear 1 year. They just simply don't do it. And also, my colleague brought up that the commissioner and they talk about these cases, these 600 cases that were a whole bunch of people got reduced sentences. Well, at the hearing for the legislation, when I asked the commissioner, could they provide the results of all of those cases? They didn't. They couldn't. Because to me, what that leads me to believe is that, well, maybe it's something they don't want us to know. Maybe already.
Or maybe they don't have that information.
Well, then if they don't have that information, then they shouldn't be touting out that all these people are getting suspended sentences. Because maybe the
Do you believe the 60% figure that everybody's touting?
Oh, yeah, no, I believe
the reduced sentences.
But what I want to look at is each individual case and the average. Because probably what's happening is the people that are being sentenced on average are probably already serving more than a year. That's probably what's happening on the ground. Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of things that we should, this legislation, in my opinion, should have been one that we debated over months. For example, I had a piece of legislation, restaurant grading, that's in place in every city in America except Baltimore, that we debated for 2 years. But we can do a mandatory minimum gun bill in a year simply so folks can say that they're trying to do something instead of coming back and having a comprehensive approach to crime and focusing on what we really can do to get crime under control.
And Eric Costello, as we finish up our conversation about this, because I do want to ask you about the Confederate monuments, what's next for this bill? I mean, are there is there a possibility that it will be amended further? Are there things that you can do to add to the bill that would address any of Councilman Scott's concerns?
No, I don't think it's going to get amended further. I believe it's going to pass on third reader, which is September 11th. And look, I agree with Councilman Scott in the need to do some of these more comprehensive things. I commend him for his work on that public safety plan, his comprehensive plan that his committee put together. I think that it's important to note, too, that the council has stepped up to start to work on some of those things. You saw that during the budget negotiations with respect to safe streets and increasing funding for the school system, after school and community school programs, et cetera. So we need to do those things, but those things are long-term goals that we need to meet. There are also short-term things that we need to do in the meantime, and those include everything from this. And again, keep in mind, this is not a panacea to fix this problem, as some people have suggested that it would be. This alone does not fix it. There are other things, federal cases like Councilman Scott is talking about. So there's a number of different things that we need to do. This is a very complex situation, and there's no one thing that is going to resolve this situation for us.
Mr. Costello, let me ask you about a letter you sent to Acting City Solicitor David Ralph. You addressed this letter to him the day after, on Sunday, the day after the horrific events in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it concerns the four Confederate monuments that we have here in our city. There's one of Lee and Jackson in Wyman Park. There's a monument to Roger Taney in Mount Vernon, right on Mount Vernon Place. There's a monument in Bolton Hill called the Confederate Soldiers and Sailors Monument, and then there's the Confederate Women's Monument, which is up on University Parkway at Charles Street. Your letter to Acting Solicitor Ralph asked what and for what reason did you address this letter to him?
Sure. So, you know, I agree that the statues need to be removed. Serious recontextualization probably isn't going to do the trick here. But there's a number of legal requirements that need to be addressed in order to ensure that those statues can be expeditiously removed. Those things vary everywhere from easements that exist for three of the four statues between the City of Baltimore and the Maryland Historical Trust to potential financial interests that whoever donated those statues to the city have. For example, this morning I just got done meeting with the Reverend at Memorial Episcopal Church in Bolton Hill, who his church essentially helped install that monument in 1903. They've reached out to their archives to get the original program and sermon from when it was installed to get a better understanding of the historical context behind it. The bottom line, though, is that those statues need to get removed, and what I was trying to do with that letter, what I'm hoping to accomplish, and I've asked for a response by Friday of this week, is lay out the path for me. What are the legal requirements so that we can ensure that there are no excuses as to why these statues cannot get removed as expeditiously as possible?
Do you fear legal action were you to remove some of these by, you know, generations on of people who might have been related to the people who put them up in the first place? Because some of these, you know, date from the early 1900s. The Lee and Jackson Monument dates from 1948. And these have been up there for a long time.
I don't know that I fear legal action. I think that it's not as simple as just tearing them down. There are legal requirements, and we need to understand what those legal... We should already understand what those legal requirements are, let me put it that way. And once we understand exactly what those are, we need to move expeditiously to overcome those legal requirements to do whatever it is we need to do. For example, you know, the mayor says that she has reached out to the Maryland Historical Trust. Okay, well, let's get an answer from them about whether or not they're willing to terminate that easement so that we can move forward with their removal.
Eric Costello represents Baltimore's 11th District on the Baltimore City Council. He's also the chair of the Judiciary and Legislative Investigations Committee. And Mr. Costello, I know we're going to lose you now. You've got things to do, places to go, eggs to lay, but we will we'll look forward to having you back on the show sometime soon. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate it.
Second District Councilman Brandon Scott joins me in the studio, and he'll be back with me after we take a quick break to talk more about monuments, about mandatory minimums, and about the Public Service Committee's plan to end violence here in Baltimore. 410-662-8780. That's how you can get in touch with us here on the phone on midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. If you want to join us on Twitter, that's a great idea, @MiddayTomHall. Stay with us.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us on this rainy Monday. At least it's rainy here in Baltimore. Coming up a little later today, a conversation with the comedian Harry Kondabolu. And coming up tomorrow on our program, Center Stage Artistic Director Kwame Kwe Arma, OBE, joins me to talk about his plans for the theater as he enters his last season. Then Paula Dofat joins me to talk about the hit documentary Step. Ms. Dofat is a college counselor at the Baltimore Leadership School for Young Women who's featured in this acclaimed documentary. So join us tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is 2nd District Baltimore City Councilman Brandon Scott. He serves as chair of the council's Public Safety Committee. Last week, he and his committee released a plan to curb the horrific violence on Baltimore streets, and he also introduced a bill concerning the status of the Confederate monuments in our city last night at the City Council meeting. The mayor, Mayor Pugh, has also issued a plan, which she refers to as an update. You are welcome to join us to talk about monuments and plans to curb violence and mandatory minimum, whatever is on your mind concerning the Baltimore City Council. 410-662-8780 to speak with Brandon Scott. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Councilman, when it comes to monuments, you want to get the ball rolling much quicker than Mr. Costello or even the mayor.
Well, no, I don't disagree with my colleague. I think that what I'm saying is, and what the entire council said last night, that via our vote, is that as soon as legally possible, we need to deconstruct these monuments so they can no longer be placed up in, for the public. My personal opinion is that we should melt them down and use the materials to erect things for true Baltimore heroes. Folks like, you know, let's say Henrietta Lacks, Thurgood Marshall, Reginald F. Lewis, Reggie Lewis, Harriet Tubman. Those are the kind of people. We don't have a statue here in Baltimore for the first African-American mayor, Clarence Dew Burns. Those are the kind of things that we should use. That these should not be sent to another community where black people live, because it's just as disrespectful to them. It's actually more disrespectful, in my opinion, for me as a black man to just stand on the wayside and say, okay, yeah, Brandon, you went to St. Mary's College. You lived in St. Mary's for 4 years. Don't say anything when your city tries to send statues down to St. Mary's, when you know the history of that county, you know the racism that those folks have to live in, you know the history of Point Lookout itself. I can't simply sit by and let that happen.
So they shouldn't be in Baltimore and they shouldn't be anywhere else.
They shouldn't be. I can't say this enough. You don't go to Germany and go to public and see statues of Hitler. You don't go to Iraq and see statues of Saddam. We don't erect monuments for people who lost wars and who were terrorists. Why do we have these? These folks, this is what they were. They were traitors, and they were people who wanted to keep people enslaved so they can continue to terrorize a whole race of folk in our country. They should not be on public display anywhere.
So we have an email from John who says your guest is demagoguing the non-issue of statues. He points out that at Appomattox, where General Lee and General Grant signed the declaration of the end of the war, at Appomattox, General Lee told his men to lay down their arms, to go home and become good citizens. On the other hand, if he had told these men to take to the hills and engage in guerrilla warfare, and then he puts in ellipses, he says that's why all Americans should honor Robert E. Lee?
Well, I think that we know exactly what happened after the war was that they went back and created new laws and new regulations and started to terrorize people in another way. They created the Ku Klux Klan. They went through the period was supposed to be Reconstruction. They created Jim Crow. So we know they did engage in different ways of terrorism and different ways of warfare. So no, we should not be honoring these persons. And it's not demagogue. We're just calling it is what it is. The facts are the facts.
Second District Baltimore City Councilman Brandon Scott joins me here in the studio. By the way, we are on Facebook Live. If you'd like to tune in to the WIPR Facebook page, be terrific. You can join us then, there. And you can also join us on the phone, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to David in Butchers Hill. David, welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Nice to be there. I wanted to say something about Roger Taney, you know, specifically about that monument. Roger Taney, there's more to Roger Taney than the Dred Scott decision. He inherited slaves and he freed them, and he gave the older ones pensions. Also, he presided over the Amistad case, where the Supreme Court found in favor of the African, you know, prisoners. And so he personally was devout Catholic. He personally thought that slavery was evil. So, but you know, I get, you know, for when he did the Dred Scott, he probably just thought it was a law or, you know, original intent or something like that. But I think there's a lot more to his long career. He was a
Thank you for your point, David. I appreciate it. Of course, for those folks who don't remember Dred Scott, 1857, Taney authored the decision that basically declared African-Americans non-citizens, that they couldn't be citizens. So, you know, Brandon Scott, David, and a whole host of other folks are willing to give Roger Taney a pass, saying that, you know, all historical figures are complicated individuals and we're all complex. We can't concentrate on just one thing.
I'm not saying they can't give him a pass. I'm just simply saying that we shouldn't have a statue in the city of Baltimore that is predominantly African American to have a statue for a man who said that I can't be a citizen, that it's impossible for me to be a citizen. That's all I'm saying.
We have an email from Dustin who says, I share Councilman Scott's indignation and desire to liberate our public spaces from these symbols of white supremacy. I propose that our city council and the mayor resolve to construct a monument to the African-American women and men of Maryland who sacrificed for the Union and through their day-to-day acts of resistance ultimately destroyed the slave system in Maryland. So he's suggesting something that is
counterpoint.
Sort of chronologically equivalent to these folks who were 19th century figures. Does it matter to you one way or the other?
No, it doesn't. I mean, that's why I thought about Harriet Tubman, talk about Frederick Douglass, those kind of folks. But to me, we need to take back these spaces. We cannot, in light of the acts of domestic terrorism that were carried out by these white supremacist group last week, cities across the country and states across the country should be immediately moving to get rid of these things so that these folks don't have lightning rods to come to spread their hate.
What do you think about what happened in Durham, North Carolina yesterday, where activist protesters who were protesting in solidarity with the people in Charlottesville, Virginia, actually put a rope around a statue and ripped it down themselves?
Yeah, it actually reminds me of what happened to the Saddam Hussein statue that you saw consistently being ran over on CNN after the U.S. came in. And for me, I want to do it in a different way here. I want us to melt them down and repurpose them. I don't want us to have to get to that point. I think that the city itself can do what we're supposed to do and represent our people and do it in the right way.
Joe in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Councilman Scott.
Yes. With all the problems that we have in Baltimore City, Councilman Scott is the type of politician who creates problems. Why doesn't he take the initiative to do something about the crime? Why doesn't he do something about the initiative about the homicide? Why does he take the initiative to do something about the school system? Instead, he picks this issue. It's almost Orwellian. They're going to blot out history. They're going to erase a history, whether you liked it or not. That's the history of the country. It's Orwellian. Why doesn't he do something productive? Because if he took them all out tomorrow, the crime rate would still be high, the homicides would still be happening, and the school system will still suck. Why doesn't he do something productive instead of demagogue on radio?
Well, Joe, I'm glad you said that. Two things. One, I think you should check your internet search history for me. I'm the person who I actually lead a nonviolent group against anti-violence. We actually renovated a row full of homes to deal with the homicides and shootings and in Baltimore, no elected official speaks out about the homicides and the shootings in Baltimore and the crime in Baltimore more than I do. But what I will tell you is, especially when you talk about the school system, I think that this is what you folks have to realize. The city doesn't control the school system. So there's literally nothing in my legislative power that I can do to help the school system. The only thing that I can do is what we did this year, as you heard Councilman Costello mention earlier, is to give them more money. The city also has no legislative power over the police department. So there's nothing in my power that I can do to change the function of the police department except impact their budget. But as a man, as a leader, elected leader in the city, I am always going to be, I am, just had the police commissioner and his folks before me last week talking about the crime. I'm the person, the biggest supporter of law enforcement that we have. But what we can do is be balanced. I have the ability to do more than one thing at once. I'm capable of that. And this is an easy thing. This isn't taking a lot of energy. It took me 5 minutes to write that resolution. I spent more time talking to you on the phone here now than I did on that resolution, and it'll take less effort for the city to get rid of those statues. We can do more than one thing at once, and that's what we have to do. That's what we're elected to do. We can't just worry about one thing, because I would love to spend my entire day to try to work and deal with the crime and violence, and we've actually prepared a comprehensive violence reduction plan from the city council. But the truth is that I also spend a good bit of my time helping constituents with other things. Trash pickup, you know, dirty streets, dirty alleys, light houses, scholarships, school issues, everything. And that's what we have to do. I don't get to pick and choose what I do. My citizens determine what I focus on. For me, the violence and public safety as a chair of the public safety committee is always number one for me. But that does not mean I'm going to turn a blind eye to simple things that committee address. This is low-hanging fruit.
Councilman Brandon Scotti represents the 2nd District. He's here with me on Midday. I'm Tom Hall, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. We're also streaming on Facebook Live. Brandon Scott, what Joe's call indicates to me, and to many folks, I think, is that this conversation about the monuments isn't about statues. It's about race, obviously. And when Joe uses the rhetoric that includes the word productive, it would be productive if the schools were better. It would be productive if there were less crime. It would be productive for this, that, and the other thing. As a person who I'm going to assume is white, he does not appear to acknowledge how productive it would be for people of color to see these statues come down.
Yeah, I was talking with some friends of mine who were white yesterday, and they were trying to who agree with me that they should be taken down, but they don't. They say, "Well, why can't they go into a museum?" And I simply said to them, "You have to think about it like this." I said, "For me, for the black people in America, in Baltimore and beyond, having these statues up is similar to having up statues from the people who carried out 9/11." There's no different. And that's what folks have to understand, because you have to think about the conversation around slavery and the Confederacy right now. What it should be in 2017 is, how is the United States government going to repay black people for what they've been through? But we don't have that discussion. If we can't even talk about removing monuments, how can we get to the point where a country that pays out money to countries for everything under the sun, but we can't find a way to repay people who literally built this country for free? As the T-shirt says, we built this joint for free.
And the fancy term that Eric Costello mentioned, which has been part of this conversation, recontextualization, which is one of the things that the commission that Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake put together to make recommendations as to what to do with this. Their recommendations included for some of these statues to have plaques next to the statues that say in no uncertain terms who these people were and what the consequences of their actions were. So David writes an email as well and says, "Why aren't we leaving the monuments and putting up a plaque the same size as the monument, stating what this person actually stood for and what his beliefs cost America?" So what's your take on, you know, the efficacy or the appropriateness of simply keeping the monument as a piece of history to remind people of a terrible era in our nation's development, but to say in no uncertain terms what it meant?
No. we can read the history in history books. The stuff they have stuff in the museum. They have Confederate museums across the country. Everyone has access to the internet in America these days. The history is always going to be there, but we don't need to put these things up. Recontextualization does not work, because we were having this discussion because the commission says that it should be recontextualized for the soldiers' monument and it should stay there. But to me, to a black person, basically that's just saying it's okay. That's what it means. We don't have statues. If that were the case, Tom, we would have statues of black people hanging from trees all across this country to remind people of what happened in those trees. But we don't do that. And I'm going to be thrown under the bus and basically lynched for even saying that. If we had that, imagine how people would feel, right? They wouldn't go for that. This is no different. These things need to come down.
Will in Charles Village, welcome to Midday with Councilman Brandon Scott.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call to comment on the idea, sort of, that issue of recontextualization doesn't really address the fact that a lot of the statues were put up way after the Civil War and were kind of a result of the resurgence of racism and, you know, the Jim Crow system, like the coming back of sort of Confederate movements and like the Ku Klux Klan, like the second rise of the Ku Klux Klan. So I think the argument that we need to sort of keep those statues as a reminder of history or recontextualize them sort of ignores that they were never contemporary to the history they're trying to memorialize. They're really sort of just not so veiled expressions of racial intolerance.
Well, thank you for the call.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. We know when most of them were built, some as late as the 1940s here in Baltimore. So clearly the Confederacy was long gone and had long lost the war. And we know that, and that's another point to go back to what we're seeing with now. We know that we have these historical periods where racism comes back out and these groups come back out, these right-wing white supremacist groups come back out. And we have one right now.
This weekend, yeah.
Right now, we're allowing that to happen. We have a coward for a president who refused to, until overwhelmingly worldwide pressure, to call it what it was, white supremacy and domestic terrorism. We cannot stand by. The leadership in this country is going to have to be at the state and local level, because we cannot depend on this president to do what's right.
Bill sends an email that says it's not correct to refer to the Roger Taney statue as a Confederate statue. We should point out that there are several Roger Taney statues, by the way. Taney died in 1864 as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. The Civil War ended, of course, in 1865. Diane writes, if the statues are destroyed, we are really rewriting our history. This is an argument we hear a lot of times. Diane continues, these statues belong in our museums with proper documentation, because destroying them negates the history without acknowledging it.
Well, there's, like I said again, the history is always going to be the history. And as the previous caller stated, these weren't built during that time. So these weren't built to say, oh, this is our history that we want to preserve. They were built to say, oh, listen, black people, this is a reminder for you to stay in your place. And our place is at the same place as everyone else. And we cannot even begin to, how can we talk about the institutional racism and the structural racism that we have when we can't simply agree that to remove things, just simple pieces of metal that show that those things exist?
Let's move on to a conversation about the crime plan that both you and the members of the Public Service Committee and Mayor Pugh have adduced. We have a question about that, as far as I can tell. Dave in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Councilman Scott.
Thank you, Tom. Wonderful program. Where do the guns come from? That seems to be a piece that's missing here. Is it Virginia, Bad Apple gun stores? I mean, if you could really identify, and I've asked numerous higher ups this question and never gotten an answer. If you could identify it, you could maybe drain the swamp, is a common saying.
All right, Dave, I appreciate the call. Thanks. I mean, Brandon Scott, we do know, we have some information about where they're coming from.
We do, and actually inside of the council's plan, Live to Be More, which you can actually find at the top of my Twitter page on Twitter at Councilman BMS, we actually call for, we have a resolution pending now where we think cities across the country have started to implement what they call a gun crime intelligence center, where no matter what happens, if it's just celebratory gunfire or shooting or someone finds bullets or a gun, every bullet should be traced so that the city can work with the federal and other law enforcement partners around the area in a regional fashion, federal and those partners, to track down the people that are shooting people with the gun, but also those that are selling them, because we have to think about guns beyond the people that are carrying them on the street, because we know that a lot of guns in Baltimore that end up in the streets of Baltimore are straw purchases, right? They're purchased either in Pennsylvania or Virginia or most of them in Maryland and given to someone else. But we do not go after those people. And we should be going after them. And one of the ways to go after them is to begin to trace all that stuff back, because we have to do that if we're going to tackle. The guns are the problem. When you look at Baltimore or the United States, for that matter, versus our partners in Europe, who have in sometimes much more poverty but have much less crime, the only thing different is that they don't have the same level of guns.
Your plan and the mayor's plan, very similar in a lot of ways. One of the things that's popped out of the mayor's plan is her suggestion that we provide free community college to graduates of Baltimore City Public Schools. She estimates that cost to be about $1.5 million. That's about $700,000 more dollars than it would take to remove all four statues. She's estimated that cost to be about $800,000. Do you think that particular part of the proposal has legs?
I love it. That's something, you know, for me, look, the mayor and I have not always agreed on stuff, but when I disagree, I disagree. This is an excellent thing. This is something that cities across the country is doing. I've already offered up to the administration and publicly for that fact that I know a way that we can pay for it. We have a free bus system in downtown Baltimore called the Charm City Circulator, which we could simply charge a dollar for like they do in D.C., which is where we got the idea for a circulator for, and use that money to fund it.
There's the short term and the long term when it comes to violence in Baltimore. The problem of guns and gangs did not develop overnight, and as the commissioner and many others have stated often, it's not going to end overnight. However, people, given the crisis that we have, and it's a crisis. I mean, we are on track to have, a record number of homicides in our city, and the homicides are happening in the same places
they were happening
20 years ago, 40 years ago, 80 years ago. It's crazy. So, in the short term, what should we be doing? What are the police not doing that they could be doing? What's the state's attorney not doing that she could be doing? What are you not doing that you could be doing?
Well, actually, that's the first thing I think about every day when I wake up. What can I be doing more? But just to talk about very quickly to what we have, six things in Live to Be More that we think are instant things that can be done.
Again, Live to Be More is your crime plan from the Public Service Committee.
From the Public Safety Committee, yes, sir. The first thing is that we know that the administration, the mayor's office, and the FOP and the police department are negotiating. The biggest hindrance right now to us is the contract that mandates the schedule for the police department. The police department is short in patrol. We know that they're extremely short. We're having to draft people to do basic patrol in the city of Baltimore each and every day. And until the commissioner and the commanders have the ability to set a schedule and set a pathway to match what we have.
So the contract really is key here.
It's key, because that schedule is out of that contract and they're able to create one that works for Baltimore, then we will have the flexibility needed. So that's number one for us. The second one is adopt a recruitment and hiring plan to fill all open positions at BPD. We think that we should reinstitute Baltimore Gun Stat, which is a city stat that we had when we had low violence and the lower violence in the city that really went through the guns and traced those guns, traced those cases, traced those incidents, traced those people. We have to use data to attack the problem as well. We said launch a youth safety network a few years ago, even back when I was working for the mayor's office of criminal justice, doing work for them in office and neighborhoods. When a young person was shot, there would be like a triage around that young person, right? If a young person was a victim of a non-fatal shooting, that young person automatically is more likely to become the victim of a homicide or the perpetrator of a non-fatal shooting or homicide. But also have to think about their siblings. So what would happen is schools, DJS, BPD, state's attorney, all these folks would triage around these young people and their families to see their situation, to see if they were in DSS custody, see if they were in DJS custody, to see if we could relocate their whole entire family. Those are the things that we can do.
Yeah.
Expand safe streets.
Yeah.
We know that safe streets work. We can do that today. And we also can support citizen-led crime initiatives that are going throughout the city.
Well, much more to talk about. We will take it up the next time you're here. But it's interesting that so many of the ideas are circling back to things that, you know, have been tried in the past. It's not like we have to reinvent the wheel.
No, sir. We just have to improve on it.
Yeah. Brandon Scott, he represents Baltimore's 2nd District. He's also the chair of the council's Public Safety Committee. And we'll have links to his violence reduction plan as well as that of Mayor Catherine Pugh on our website, wypr.org/midday. Councilman, it's always good to see you. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after a quick break, comedian Hari Kondabolu joins me ahead of his show at the Baltimore Creative Alliance later this month. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.